Well, tonight we're going to, you could say, finish our series in on Lent. We've been in this series for a number of weeks in the season of Lent, celebrating this season of Lent. If that's new for you, or if that's different, or that's odd, or you thought that's something that only Catholics did, or what have you, I'm not going to go back into a full explanation of it now or why we do it. What you need to do is just go back several weeks, go onto our website, and listen to one of the first sermons that Stephen preached when we kicked off this series 6 weeks ago, and he explains why this is so important. But one thing we've done through the last 6 weeks is we've been reading through the book of Mark together, because in a way, that's what Lent is about. It's journeying with Jesus towards really the cross, and what we're going to celebrate this week on Good Friday. So we're going to pick up there, and we're going to read a passage today from Palm Sunday from the book of Mark. But before we do that, we're going to take a bit of a detour, because I want to talk to you about two really important ideas, and those ideas are kings and temples. Kings and temples. Now, the reason these are important ideas is because the Bible is full of stories about kings and temples. And for us, it doesn't always make a lot of sense, because we don't have either of those things in our modern American culture. I mean, think about it. We don't have kings. We have a president who we get to choose, whom we get to elect. He gets 4 years, maybe 8 years. Everything he wants to do or tries to do has to be approved by the Congress or the courts or the people at some level. If we don't like it, we can disagree. If we don't like it, we can protest. If we don't like it, we can vote him or her out of office. And so the way we see leaders in our current sort of modern nation is entirely different from the way kings ruled in the ancient world. Now, temples are an odd thing as well. We don't have temples in our culture. We have church buildings. We have sanctuaries. We have mosques. We might even have auditoriums. But we don't see these buildings in the sacred way that temples were seen in the ancient world. Now, again, kings and temples are important, because if you try to read through the Bible, you come across all these stories about one of these things. And you get to this point where you realize that, that there's so much about kings and there's so much about temples that you don't even understand what's going on with these kings and temples. There's all these stories about different kings. There's all these intricate details and plans about temples in the ancient world. And we don't even understand, and it gets boring or it gets tedious. Maybe you've tried to read, anybody tried to read through the Old Testament and gotten part of the way through and not made it to the end? Like, that's part of the reason is because there's so many stories about kings and temples. And then Jesus comes along, and what does he talk about? A kingdom. And then we're going to read all these stories this week where he talks about temples. And so if you want to understand the Bible, if you want to understand Jesus, then you've got to understand what kings and temples are about. So I want to tell you a little bit. Actually, let's go back a few slides here. Let's go back to kings in the ancient world. And I want to first start by telling you, and just hang with me, because you're going to wonder, where is this going? Like, are we going to read the Bible tonight? I promise, we'll read the Bible tonight. But hang with me, because this is really important. Let me tell you about kings in the ancient world. For starters, kings were not elected. They were not chosen by the people. They weren't part of a democracy. They weren't limited to two terms. And there's a few characteristics that are important about kings. For starters, they ruled over their subjects with unparalleled authority and sovereignty. You were either the king or you were a subject of the king. There was no middle ground. And if you were not the king, which was almost really everybody else, if you were a subject of the king, you did what the king said. It was as simple as that. Now, the second thing about kings is they used their power, this unparalleled power they had, they used their power to amass wealth and a lavish lifestyle for themselves. The most common way they did this was through taxes. Taxes are not a new thing. They would raise taxes on the people. And any amount of money you made, you had to give a percentage of that to the king. Any amount of grain that you harvested, a percentage of that went to the king. Any cows or sheep or goats in your flock, a percentage of that went to the king. Any amount of land that you owned, a percentage of that went to the king. And so the king would take all of this money and all of this wealth and amass it, usually for himself. And often he would take this money and he would build huge buildings. First, he would build a huge palace for himself because he would live in this lavish lifestyle that was totally different from everyone else. And then he would often build other residences all across the kingdom where he could go and stay. He would have a mountain home and a beach home and all these different residences. And then he would build statues and monuments and sometimes even elaborate burial tombs so that even when the king died, he would be buried in this lavish tomb so that people for generations to come would be able to say, that guy was the sovereign king over our kingdom. So that was one thing kings did. But then the last thing you need to know about kings is they focused on defending and enlarging their kingdom with military might. Because the bigger the kingdom was, the more territory you had, the more subjects you had, the more prestigious you were as a king. And so they were always defending themselves against anyone else who was trying to take over their territory. And then they were trying to build up their army to take over more territory and more subjects from other smaller and weaker kingdoms. And how do you think they defended themselves and built up their army? Through more taxes. Through more wealth they took from the people, through conscripting the people to be in the army, so that when the king said, hey, you need to help me pay for new fortresses, for new towers, for new walls, you pretty much had to do it. Or you need to help me go fight next spring because we're going to attack the Moabites or we're going to attack the Philistines. You had to do what the king's. You either obeyed and you fought for the king, or you probably would lose your life. Now, this is how kings acted in the ancient world. Let me give you a couple examples. Because the most obvious example of this kind of king is the Pharaoh of Egypt. The word Pharaoh is just the Egyptian word for king. And so the Pharaohs ruled over Egypt and they amassed great wealth. They built lavish palaces for themselves. They enslaved the people of their kingdoms. We know those stories about the Israelites underneath them being enslaved the people to build their projects for them. And in fact, they built some of the most lavish burial tombs we could ever see. And they're still standing today, the huge pyramids in Egypt. They extended their borders. They were always fighting people on the west and on the east, on the south to do everything they could. This is how the Pharaoh acted. One more example, the Persian king, Xerxes. You might remember if you were here, if you're new, you obviously don't, but if you were here a year ago, we did a whole series in the book of Esther in the Bible. And it's all about this Persian king named Xerxes. And at the very beginning of the book, he's the king over Persia and he throws this elaborate 6-month long party where the wine is flowing and everyone's drunk and everyone is basically there to celebrate the king. And at some point in that party, he decides, hey, let's send for the queen, his wife, and let's have her come and show off her beauty to everyone here. And you remember what she says? No. She says, no, I'm not going to do it. And how does he respond? He deposes her as queen and goes and finds another queen. Because she wasn't his wife, first and foremost. She wasn't the queen. She was a subject of the king, first and foremost. And if you don't do what the king says, then he will not hesitate to get rid of you. So this is just a couple of examples of kings in the ancient world. Now, let me tell you about temples. Because kings and temples went hand in hand. Because every kingdom had a god that they worshipped. They had a god that they believed in, that they believed was blessing their specific nation and their specific kingdom. And so they worshipped this god. And they often believed that the king was God's representative on earth. And so oftentimes then the king would build a temple to their god. And when they built these temples, there were a few things that were characteristic of the temples. For starters, we need to understand that the temples were understood as the residence of the kingdom's god on earth. It was where the god actually lived. It was the one place you could experience the god. It was the one place you could meet with. You could worship the god. You could offer sacrifices. You could even bring food to the god. And so the kings would build these temples. And in fact, the most common word in ancient Hittite and Akkadian languages for temple was just house of God. It was God's house. It's where God lived and resided. Now, another thing that temples did in the ancient world is they consolidated religious control in the capital city of the kingdom. Temples weren't usually built somewhere else. They were usually built in the capital city. Because think about it. If you're the king, do you want another city building a huge temple to the god and emerging as sort of a rival to the capital city where you live and where your palace is and where you reign from? No. So kings never wanted to give priests, they never wanted to give other cities too much control. And so they would always build the central or the main temple of the kingdom right there in their capital city, because kings weren't just interested in consolidating political control and economic control. They also wanted to consolidate religious control right there under their hand in the capital city. Now, last, temples provided the king with unique access to the deity. Guess where the temples were usually built in the capital city? Right next to the palace of the king. And in fact, the temple was usually seen as the king's chapel. It was like his personal chapel. It was his own place where he could access God. It was like his direct line to God. And oftentimes, subjects weren't even allowed in the temple itself. Sometimes there would be outer courtyards, and that's where the subjects of the kingdom could go. But usually the temples in the ancient world were set up in such a way that there would be a room inside the very back of the temple that was the throne room, where they believed this is where the deity actually lived. And so this is a diagram, this is an example I wanted to give you of Ayin Dara. This is the ruins of a temple that's been found in modern-day Syria. It's been dated to about 1300 BC, which was before the Israelites even left Egypt, before they had come into the Promised Land, before most of the Old Testament ever happens. So this is from Ayin Dara. It's a Neo-Hittite temple, which is a group of people that lived back then. And you can see there's the ruins on the right. On the top, there's these huge footsteps. And those were seen as the footsteps of the deity who's going in to reside in the temple. There's these outer courtyards. There's a portico right there, and then you go up some steps. There's this initial room that's often called an antechamber, and then there's a second bigger room called the main hall, and then at the back, there's the throne room. And that's where the throne would be, where the God would actually sit. They would believe that the God would actually sit on his throne, and from that place and that temple, together with the king over the kingdom, the people's God would rule over the kingdom. And this was typical. We have all kinds of other archaeological examples. We found this was typical of temples in the ancient world. Now, why this long history lesson? You're probably wondering. I didn't know we were going to class tonight, but I thought it would be important for a couple of reasons. Because when God births the kingdom of Israel, when God leads the people out of Egypt, out from being under the kingship of Pharaoh and slavery there, he brings them into the wilderness, and he basically says a few things. We're not going to read it. We won't go through this. But in Exodus, I'm just going to summarize it in a few sentences. He basically says, you're going to be a new kingdom of people, and I'm going to be your king. Because I am your God. And I want you to worship me. And I saved you. And so now I want you to worship me. And I want you to serve me. And I want you to obey me. And then he says, the way you can obey me is I'm going to give you a bunch of laws that are going to structure your society. And there's all kinds of laws and rules that God gives. The Ten Commandments and many other things there at Mount Sinai. And as part of those laws, he gives them these intricate instructions for building a tabernacle. Now, the word tabernacle is really biblical and religious sounding, but really it just means a tent. It was a canvas tent. It was this tent that they took up and set down, or set up and took down. So he gave them these plans for this canvas tent, and he basically says, what I'm going to do is I'm going to lead you on your journey. And every time I say stop, I want you to stop and set up the tent. And when you set up the tent, this is where you can come. You can come inside this tent and you can worship me. You can meet with me. If you've done something wrong, you can offer sacrifices and you can find forgiveness for me. You can get guidance for me. You can get direction for me. And then when it's time to leave, I'll tell you when it's time to leave, and you pack up the tent and you move, and you ultimately, what I want you to do is follow me. And so God says, I'm going to actually lead you. I'll show you this cloud by day and this pillar of fire by night. And I just want you to follow me. And so here's some instructions for this portable, movable tent. And every time you get a word from me, stop, set it up, worship me there. And then when it's time to go, but you're just going to have to trust me and follow me and listen to me. Because I'm your God and I'll be your king. And so I want you to worship me, obey me, and follow me. Now, the people listen. They commit to following God right there at Mount Sinai. They stumble a lot along the way. Remember, it takes them 40 years to get through the wilderness. They're setting up and taking down this tent all along the way. They finally make their way into the Promised Land. Things don't get much easier there. They're basically 12 different tribes. They live in all these different areas. They go through these difficult times, but God always raises up a leader. Sometimes it's called a judge. We have this whole book called Judges. There's these leaders that God would raise up to bring the people back to him. But eventually they kind of start settling down. The tent starts getting moved around all over Israel. We know it's in the city called Gilgal for a while. It's in another city called Shiloh for a while. So they're still trying to set up this tent and take it down. And they start getting these ideas that, man, this isn't very efficient. This isn't a great way to run a kingdom. And so look at what they do. They come to one of their leaders. And this is from 1 Samuel chapter 8. Verse 4. I want to read a few verses. We'll put them on the screen. So all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "You are old." How's that for like the greeting? Like, no, hey, how's it going? How's your week been? Like, just, you're old. "And your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." In other words, Samuel, you've been leading us for some time. You're this prophet, this kind of leader that kind of, whenever we get off course, you lead us back. But your sons, they're not as good as you are. Like, they're not as good. And honestly, if we could be honest for a second, like, even under your leadership, it's just kind of been inconsistent. We never know how things are going to go. We need more stability. We want a king. I mean, all the Canaanites have a king. The Moabites have a king. The Edomites have a king. Like, everyone else has a king, and it seems to work great. We want a king like all the other nations have. Look at how Samuel responds. And this is a bunch of verses, so I'm just going to kind of read through them quick. But they're important. Verse 11, he says this. "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and will make them serve with his chariots and horses. And they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and other to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves, and he'll give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage, and he'll give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys, he will take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." So basically, Samuel's saying, do you realize what you're asking for? You know what kings are like, right? This is how kings are. They're going to take everything you have. They're going to focus on building up their wealth. They're going to focus on building up their armies and their military power, and they're just going to turn you into slaves. That's what God saved you from. You want to go back to, that's what you're asking for. But the people don't listen. And they keep asking for a king like all the other nations have. And Samuel starts taking it personally. I mean, he goes to God, and he's mad, and he's angry, and he's praying to God. And it's like, God, am I not good enough for them? And look at what God tells him. Verse 7. "And the Lord told him, 'It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king.'" This isn't about you, Samuel, and your leadership. This is about me. They've rejected me as their king. But in that moment, God is gracious and God is patient. And you know how he responds to the people? He says, okay, you want a king? Like all the other nations, that's what you want? All right, we'll give it a try. We'll go with that and we'll see how it works. And so he gives them a king. The first king is Saul. The next king is David. We know some of the stories about it. David's a warrior. David knows how to fight. When David becomes king, he fights the Philistines. When David becomes king, he extends the borders. When David becomes king, he takes a city called Salem, which would become Jerusalem. And then he actually renames it after who? Himself. Becomes the city of David. He builds up the defenses. He makes it the capital of the kingdom. And once he's defeated all of his enemies and extended the borders as far as they go, David gets a new idea about what they should do next. Look at what happens. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1. After the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him, he said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I am living in a house of cedar," which was a nice material back then. "I'm living in this lavish palace of cedar while the ark of God remains in a tent." The ark of God was just this box where they put the Ten Commandments in to remember the covenant they had made with God at Mount Sinai. And it went along with the whole tent assembly. It was part of the tent when they would set it up to meet with God. And basically David's saying, I've got this great palace that I'm living in, but God doesn't have a great house and palace where he's living in. I know what we need to do. We need to stop setting up and taking down that tent all the time. We need to build a temple for God. And look at how God responds. Verse 5. This is what the Lord says. Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. I've been moving around from place to place with a tent as my dwelling. And wherever I've moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of their rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, why have you not built me a house of cedar? It's like God is saying, David, why do you want to build me a temple? I mean, I've never had a temple. I've never asked for a temple. I've never wanted a temple. I mean, maybe you want a nice, lavish palace to live in, but I don't want that. I mean, in the hundreds of years, ever since I told your ancestor Moses to build this tent and to set it up and to take it down and to trust me and to follow me and to just to wait and see where I lead you, have I ever once said, hey, let's stop right here and build a temple here. Hey, I want a permanent place for you to build, for me to live in. I've never said that, David. And it's almost like God doesn't want to be confined. God doesn't want to be controlled or managed. God doesn't want to be located in one place or almost put metaphorically in a box. It's almost as if God is saying, no, no, no. My ways are different. My kingdom is going to be different, not like all the other nations. But just like before, when the people demand a king, and the people, through David, demand a temple, God's gracious, and he's patient, and he says, okay, I'll let you build a temple. I don't want you to build it, because you're kind of a warrior, and I don't want it to be associated with that. I'll let your son build it. I didn't really ask for this, but I'll take up residence in your temple and we'll see how it works. We'll see where this goes. And so sure enough, David raises a bunch of money and he raises a bunch of people and plans. And then when he dies, his son Solomon builds this lavish temple. But just a side note, before he builds the temple, Solomon builds a new palace for himself. The palace his father built, David, wasn't good enough. And so in the largest project in Israelite history, Solomon builds a palace for himself. And he has to raise taxes and conscript labor. And it takes 13 years because it's so huge. And guess where he builds the temple? Right next to his palace. Right there in the capital city of Jerusalem. And it's just like all the other temples in the ancient world. There's a big portico out front. There's stairs that lead up. There's two huge columns. There's this entranceway, and then there's a main hall. And then at the back, there's this throne room. And they call it the Holy of Holies. And there's actually this throne where it's believed God would come down and sit and reside. Because we want a king just like all the other nations have. And we want a temple just like all the other nations have. Now, where do you think all this leads? Well, sure enough, over the years, the kings follow in Solomon and all the other nations' kings' paths. They end up just focusing on amassing wealth. They end up corrupt. They end up focusing on their armies and their military defenses and their military allegiances with other kingdoms. And they eventually lead the people away from God. And then the temple becomes this place where political deals are struck, where idolatry slowly creeps in, where the priests become just as corrupt as the kings themselves. It even becomes this place of national pride. Look at how great and grand and beautiful our temple is. Our God must be blessing us. Because look at our temple. And there's this facade of religiosity about it all. They still are going to church every Sunday, right? I mean, they're still going to the temple. They're still offering sacrifices. They're singing the songs. They're mouthing the words. But deep down, God knows they don't really mean it. They don't care about this. I mean, look at their lives. They've rejected his law. They oppress the poor. There's no justice in the land. I mean, nothing about their lives is any different than all the other people in all the other nations. And so God knows deep down, they don't really worship me or care about me. In fact, prophets would rise up and would challenge this. I want to read you just one of them. A guy named Jeremiah one day stands on the steps of the temple itself. And look at what he says. This is from Jeremiah 7. Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, because that shows me what's really important to you. Reform your ways and actions, and I'll let you live in this place. But do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. You are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. You see, Jeremiah knew they just put their trust in this idea that they were in God's good favor because they had this beautiful temple and God loved Israel and he was their people, and they were just trusting in that. They weren't actually trusting in God himself. Now there's another prophet named Ezekiel. We're not going to read him because he's a little bit hardcore. I've thought about preaching from Ezekiel, but I've never done it because I'm kind of scared to do it because he's so hardcore. Because he starts calling, he sees how terrible the people are becoming, and he starts calling them prostitutes. He says, you've sold your souls. And it eventually gets so bad that Ezekiel realizes God doesn't want to have any part in this anymore. And so he has this vision. And the vision is God's presence actually leaving the temple. It's this vision where God is saying, I don't want to live here anymore. This is not my residence anymore. I'm leaving. And he sees in this vision God's spirit leaving the temple. Which is why, a few years later, God allowed the kingdom of Israel to be destroyed. And he allowed the king to be deposed. And he allowed the temple of Israel to be destroyed. Because he didn't want to have any part in this anymore. Because the people weren't representing who he was anymore to all the other nations around them. That happened in 586 BC. About 600 years later. By the time of Jesus, the Jews had rebuilt the temple. It had become what it was known as the Second Temple. And they were longing for a new king. Because despite all of their failures, despite all of the warnings of their prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, despite the fact that the first temple was destroyed and the first kingdom was destroyed and Jerusalem had been destroyed, despite the fact that they, the Jewish people, had had to live in exile under the Babylonians and under the Persians, and despite the fact that the Jewish people were still, in a sense, living in exile, they come back to the land, but the Roman Empire now ruled over them. Despite all of that, many of the Jewish people still believed that if we just hold on to our temple practices and we just hold on to our pride, and if we just long for and hope that one day God's going to bring a king back. And this king is going to come with force, and he's going to come with military power, and he's going to help us overthrow the Romans and kick them out, because he doesn't care about the Gentiles. He just cares about the Jews, and he just cares about the nation of Israel. And the glory of the temple will be restored, and the glory of the nation of Israel will be restored. They were longing for the days when they could go back to their great king, their great kingdom, and their great temple. Which is why they didn't like it when a guy named Jesus starts talking about a new kingdom. And it's going to be a very different kind of kingdom. Which is why they didn't like it when Jesus started quoting the prophets and saying things like, God doesn't care about your sacrifices anymore. Sacrifices were a part of the whole temple system. This is why they were so offended when Jesus starts spending time with Gentiles and saying, guess what? This new kingdom that God is bringing, it's open even to them. It's not just for Jewish people. It's for everybody. It's for all the nations. And then it would all come to a head when Jesus and his followers would travel to Jerusalem, the ancient capital of the nation of Israel, for Passover. And in the familiar story that some of you know, I'll read it again. It's from Mark chapter 11. It says this in verse 1. As they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and just as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there which no one has ever ridden. And when they brought the colt to Jesus and they threw their cloaks over it, he sat on it. And many people, they spread their cloaks on the road, while others spread branches. And they took, we know from other gospels, they took these palm branches. That's where we get the name. And they laid them down. They spread their branches that they had cut in the fields. And those who went ahead and those who followed shouted, Hosanna, straight from Psalm 118. Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest heaven. Jesus entered Jerusalem. And where's the first place he went? He went into the temple courts. And he looked around at everything. It's almost like you wonder if he kind of just looks around like, I wonder if anything's changed. He looked around at everything. But since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. So Jesus comes into Jerusalem, and the people are longing for a king, and word has reached them, and they've heard enough, and they've seen enough as of healings and his teachings that they believe maybe this is the Messiah, maybe this is the king, but he's a totally different kind of king. He comes in on a donkey. And then the minute he gets there, he goes straight to the temple. And then we find out, we're not going to read it, but the very next morning he goes back to the temple and he throws a bunch of people out. He throws these money changers out. Because he gets there and he realizes there's this whole business system that's been set up, this business enterprise. There's these people selling merchandise. And they're selling animals that are going to be sacrificed. And there's an exclusive nature about it. There's Gentiles that are allowed in some parts of the outer courts, but they're not allowed in the inner courts. And Jesus, it's like he sees everything going on there, and he gets so angry. And so he turns over their tables, and he tells them they've got to get out. And he says, why? Because this is supposed to be a house of prayer. This is a house of worship. This is a house where people come and they meet with God. And it's not just for you, and it's not for business purposes. It's for all nations. He actually quotes the Old Testament prophets as he's driving these people out. And he says, this is a sham. This is not what God is a part of. This is not what God is in. God is going to be against this. In fact, God, he would later say that week to his disciples, he said, God is going to tear this whole system down. It's no surprise that Mark tells us the minute he drives the money changers out of the temple, look at how the people respond. Verse 18. The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this, and they began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him. Now, that's a lot of the Bible in one sermon. That's a lot of history. What's the lesson in all this? Well, for starters, I think it gives us a bigger understanding of what's going on this last week. As we walk into this week, and as you maybe read through Mark with us, and as maybe you come on Good Friday and we celebrate on Easter, this gives us a much bigger context for what's going on. Because oftentimes, it's easy for us to think this, that Jesus didn't come to be political. Jesus came to just talk about God and share these spiritual and moral stories with everyone. And that's just not true. Jesus was intensely political. I mean, everything he was doing and saying was threatening the political desires of the Jewish people in that day. Everything that he was doing and saying was so controversial because it's like he was overturning their nationalistic pride and their arrogance and their exclusivity. Every time that he was saying that God's going to welcome the Gentiles in and he's healing Gentiles, it's like he's overturning all their thoughts about what the kingdom is going to be. He was judging the temple system. He was driving the people. He was even threatening and judging the Roman Empire. It's almost as if God or Jesus was saying, you think Caesar is Lord over all this? You think Caesar is the king of this empire? He's not the king. He's not the Lord. I am the Lord. Jesus was intensely political. And that's why he ended up being crucified that week, because the powers, the political powers that be, couldn't take his vision anymore. But practically speaking, even if that gives us a bigger context for what's going on, practically speaking, how does this affect you and me personally? I want to just share two things with you real quick, and we'll end with this, because I think Jesus is boldly making two claims in what he's doing. Jesus is the king, and we are the temple. Jesus is the king, and we are his temple. Jesus is the king. For those of you who call yourselves followers of Jesus, he is our king. He's our only king, but he's unlike any other king from the ancient world, and he's unlike anything we would picture of a king or a person in power or authority in our modern world. Because he has all power, but he rides in not on a white horse, not on a chariot, not carried by, he rides in on a donkey. He has all authority, but he's humble. And he's meek, and he washes the feet of his disciples. He has every right to judge us. That's what kings do. They judge whether people are being good subjects of the king or not. He has every right to judge us, but he doesn't. He offers forgiveness and mercy when we don't live up to what he's asked us to do. He could amass all wealth, right? I mean, he could have shown up and figured out a way to amass all kinds of wealth, but he chose to be homeless. He chose to serve and spend time with the poor. He chose, instead of making a living for himself, for the most part, all from what we can tell from the Gospels, he chose to live off of the generosity of other people. He could amass military armies to extend his kingdom. Wouldn't that be the best way to extend the kingdom of God? Would it be through military power? But he doesn't. He rejects violence. He rejects military power. He chooses to spread his kingdom through love. I mean, ultimately, he could have defeated all of his enemies, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Roman armies, whoever it was that was against him, that didn't like him. He could have defeated them with any kind of power he wanted to. But when the time came that they came against him, he laid down his life. He sacrificed himself for those who had abandoned him. He even forgave those who were crucifying him. You see, he's the king. But he's a king of love. And it challenges every category of king or power or authority or leadership. For those of us who are leaders, it challenges all those categories. And it asks us and it begs us to ask new questions about what kind of king we actually serve. If he's the king, we are his temple. We are his temple. That last week, he challenged the temple system. He basically said, God is going to judge it and tear it down. That's what happened. 40 years later, in AD 70, a second temple was destroyed by the Romans. And it's never been rebuilt. And so, what embodies God's presence in the world today? It's not a temple. It's not a physical building anymore. It's us. We are the living residents of God in our world. We are, as Paul would say, we're the body of Christ. We are his body. We physically represent him in every neighborhood and city in our world. And if that sounds really odd, I just want to read one more verse to you tonight. This is what Paul told some followers of Jesus. 1 Corinthians 3, he said, "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst? For God's temple is sacred, and you together, not you individually, but you together are that temple." And so today, here's how we're going to conclude our time tonight. As we think about all these things, I think maybe the only proper response is just worshiping God. It's just saying, God, yes, you are the king, and yes, we are your temple, and so we want to worship you for being that kind of king. And so as we close our time, we're going to sing a couple of songs that are around these themes and these messages, and I would just ask you to reflect on the words as we sing them. Ask yourself, do I really believe this? Do I really worship a king who challenges all my categories about what that looks like and who that is? And maybe even as you head home tonight, as you get in your car, you go home, or you talk to somebody along the way, or you think about this tomorrow, I want you to just to think about two questions. Number one, do I really see Jesus as the king? I mean, I know he's great and he's good and all that, but do I really see him as my king? And second, do I really see myself as his temple? Do I really believe that I am the living embodiment of Jesus and God's presence in my world? I am his temple. Let me pray. God, thank you for bringing a new kingdom to this earth. Because it's clear all of our human-made kingdoms don't work very well. And so God, we trust that your kingdom is the greatest and that your kingdom is sovereign. And that your rule and your reign over this world begins with your rule and your reign in each one of our hearts and lives. And so God, as we just sing these songs tonight and as we consider who you are, I pray that you would meet us here and you would meet us in that place and you would help us to give more of our lives and more of our hearts over to trusting you as our King.